Good morning, and thank you for coming out to our Family Day Yarchei Kala. The Yarchei Kala programs in general, and I think most of the people here have been to one before, are modeled on the learning that we do internally in this Beit Midrash over the course of the year, where every morning, the morning Seder, that morning period of time, is devoted to internal study. And this year, we're learning chapter 6 and 7 of Bava Metzia. Well, don't be optimistic. We're in chapter 6 of Bava Metzia, which forms the basis for what we're going to be discussing today about breaking a verbal agreement. The learning this morning is dedicated by the Hirschkop family for Shlema, for Sarah Bat Malka, and Yisrael Ben Brach. So they should have a Refuah Shlema. A couple of notes. First, if you look at your source sheets at the top of the sheet, I gave you links. So the first three are for a three-part shiur on this topic of breaking a verbal agreement. It's a longer version of what we are going to be discussing this morning. So for anyone who wants more depth and to get more of a sense of the sources, alternative ways to read the sources, some additional debates, by all means, go ahead and take those shiurim, or a review shiur that I gave afterwards on it, which is the fourth link, much of which is what we're going to hear this morning. Second preface, it was noted during the preparation, and this is certainly true, that a lot of the discussion about breaking a verbal agreement in our day may actually be governed by the rules that people make in their own agreements and contracts. So in other words, when you agree with somebody that you're going to hire them to do a job, or when you agree to buy something, there may be certain rules that are society's rules or that you make personally, and those may well override the Torah's default rules for those kinds of contractual agreements. So what we're talking about is where there is no other agreement, there are no other rules, then how does this how does this work? So it's important to recognize that. And then the last preface is what I always say when giving a shiur on a halachic issue, which is for practical matters, please see your posek, see your halachic authority. What we're doing is discussing issues, but if there's a specific case, you should please go to the person who answers your halachic questions in general. For anyone who just came in, there are source sheets on the back table in the middle, and that's what we're going to be following. So we started out with an icebreaker question in source number one. People had a chance to see that? The case of the mall. So, to make a long story short, there's a baby boy born, mazel tov, supposed to have a bris, wonderful, but the baby wasn't ready yet. So they postponed the bris to the end of the first month. The idea is that after the first month, the child is assumed to be viable, out of the category that's called halachically a nefel, which we're not going to go into right now, but the assumption is that the child, if it makes it that far, God willing, is going to be viable. However, the father says, you know what? A month isn't sufficient. This kid needs a little more time. And so he says, I'm going to postpone the bris. In the meantime, the mall he's contracted with has just been hanging out in town and needs to go, so the mall leaves town. The father then says, you know what? After a month, the kid was cooked. I think it's okay. I think let's do the bris now. And and of course, that mall was out of town, so he calls another mall and says, I'd like you to do the bris. And lo and behold, because this is the way things work out, both of them are now back in town, same day, ready to do the bris. He has made verbal agreements with each of them, so who should be the mo? That's the Maram's question, which, God willing, we make it to the end, we'll be able to address. But I use that and the situation in source number two, which I just pulled the first line out of an article. It's a little bit more contemporary, I think, for people. I think it's a little bit more relatable to people. You signed your kid up for summer camp, and then decided that actually, or the kid decided, they don't want to go, or they're going to go somewhere else. So, what's your responsibility? Are you able to are you able to back out of that? So, the basic questions we have to ask here are: what's wrong with breaking a verbal agreement? That's number one. And number two, what sort of liability comes with breaking a verbal agreement. Clear? Okay. So you start out by noting that clearly Chazal, our sages, criticize somebody who breaks a verbal agreement. They label that kind of behavior mechusar amana, which in English is rendered as in bad faith. That's the term. It describes behavior, for our purposes, in which one breaks a verbal agreement. And I introduced this with source number 3 that you have here on the sheet. So Gemara in Bava Metzia. Rav Kahana Yavi Leizuzei Akisna. Rav Kahana grew flax. Somebody prepaid him for the flax. Early in the season, they prepay. Why would somebody prepay? They lock in a good price, sorry? Fluctuation in price, exactly. So they want to pay early before the flax is actually grown, and that way they have the right to claim the flax later on, and sure enough, the soap, Aikir Kisna, flax went up in value. So the seller, Rav Kahana, at that point, is not interested in selling the flax at the earlier price. He would like to be able to get the higher price. So Aslaka made the Rav. He goes to Rav to ask him, am I bound by this? To which the response is, whatever amount they paid for, that's what you have to give. You're out of luck. The edoch, the rest, devarim nin, it was just a verbal agreement. There's no issue of acting in bad faith as far as the verbal agreement. So you may have agreed that you're going to give them more than the value of what they put in the down payment. Nonetheless, you're not bound to keep it if you don't want to keep it. That's Rav's response. Are we okay with that idea? No, why not?
He's not keeping his word.
No, that's correct. And in fact, the Hidmar we've learned, Devarim, Rav Amar Ein Bahem Mishum Mechusari Amana. Rav says, a verbal agreement, if you break a verbal agreement, that's not called in bad faith. Rav Yochanan Amar Yesh Bahem Mishum Mechusari Amana. Rav Yochanan is with Albert. He says, no. He says, of course that's in bad faith. Who are you kidding? You agreed that you were going to provide something, and now you're not going to provide it? That's the very definition of bad faith. How can we justify Rav's position? How can we justify Rav's position? Yes, Max.
You're giving him what you paid for. It's not like you can leave that.
Yeah. You're giving him what he paid for, but you're not fulfilling the agreement that you made. Yes. There was nothing in writing, and therefore, it's not a commitment. Gerald, are you?
You could accept that there's common practice that's the way business works. So you carry an inventory. You have to be careful.
Right. You're able to make the argument that maybe this is the way people do business. Maybe the answer really is that a verbal agreement is never expected to be held. Let me try that in English. That verbal agreements are, the old line, not worth the paper they're written on. Everybody knows that you didn't actually commit that you're going to follow through. It's a general statement of understanding. However, a better deal comes along, you'll take the better deal. That could be Rob's understanding of why it's okay to back out. He says, your word is not your bond. That's not true. When are you bound? When you actually sign the papers.
I don't think Rob said it was okay to back out. He said, give him the value of the flax that he bought. So maybe Rob's reasoning was that he put he paid for that value of flax and not for a set amount of flax. If he wanted a set amount, he could have put it in writing.
Right, so the way that the Gemara reads is that there was an agreement to provide more than the amount that he paid for. So it appears. So the Gemara continues by challenging Rav. Where it says, wait a minute. We've learned, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ma Kamalomar Hin said, the Torah has several discussions about the importance of honesty. One in particular is about weights and measures. So when you run a store and you have a scale and you have weights or you sell things in volume measures, You have to make sure that your weights are, in fact, what they say they are. It says it's a shekel. It actually has to be a shekel. And you also have to make sure that your cup actually holds a cup, or your, you know, whatever it is, your liter measure holds a liter. That's a requirement. So much so that the Gemara says, the Rambam codifies as halakha, that a Jewish community is obligated to appoint officers who will circulate the Bureau of Weights and Measures and make sure that stores actually have a have an honest set of weights and measures. And the Torah introduces this by saying, you shall keep Efas Tzedek and Hin Tzedek. It actually has multiple measures for which it says they have to be Tzedek, they have to be just. They have to be set to the right amount. They have to be what they say, effectively. So the Gemara asks a question, which is, when the Torah presents this rule about having honest weights and measures, it says Efat tzedek, Efa has to be tzedek, and Hin tzedek, your Hin also has to be tzedek. Both of those are volume measures. Once you already told me that my Efa has to be honest, why do you also need to tell me that the Hin has to be honest? Right? If you had, to put it in our terms, because Efa and Hin is not something we generally use, but if you had an instruction that said to you that your pints have to be precisely a pint, would you need it to tell you your liter also has to be precisely a liter? Why would you have thought otherwise? Sorry?
We wondered the explanation of the word hin. We thought it meant yes, but it's a measure.
It's a measure. But now it's going to mean yes. So you're also right.
Another example is a gallon.
Right. So I didn't want to cross my system, but I've already crossed my systems. Yes. A gallon? Oh, so there's a Canadian gallon. Great. That's all I needed. I've lived here for 10 years. I didn't know there was a Canadian gallon. It's a Canadian gallon. Go figure.
Canadian gallon is
imperial.
There's also a
okay, so I'm going to skip all of this because I'm not taking the word hin to mean hin anyway. So the Gemara is bothered by that. Rabbi Yosef Yehuda asks, "Matam lomar hin tzedek? Why is it that the Torah has to say you have to have an honest hin, a hin measure? Velo hin bichlal eifa hayah? That's already included within the statement about the eifa, which is a larger value measure. Elo lomar lo." It teaches you, shehein shalchat tzedek, v'lav shalchat tzedek. Read the word hin like hein, meaning yes. That when you say yes, it has to be honest, and when you say no, it has to be honest. You have to mean what you say. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. How can Rav tell me it's okay to break a verbal agreement? That doesn't make any sense. Your yes has to be serious, and your no has to be serious. So, Abaye gives an answer. What's Abaye's answer? Those who saw source number 3? Sorry? Chamashmaut? Bidyuk. Right. Right. So, Chanoch says, you were going to say the same thing? That Chanoch says that when you say yes, you have to mean yes. When you say no, you have to mean no. But circumstances may change later on. What the Torah is requiring is that you mean it when you say it. Not that you plan to back out. There's no hedging in your commitment. However, later on, things happen. You RSVP saying, I'm going to be here for breakfast. At the time, you RSVP'd. You were serious. I'm going to be here for breakfast. Something happened. The alarm clock didn't go off. So therefore you ended up being later. But that's not a violation of Hin Tzedek. Your Hin was Tzedek. So that's Abaye's justification for the position of Rav. That's the idea. But this introduces us to the idea that if a person does not keep to their word within the position of Rabbi Yochanan, they are what's called mechusar amana. They're considered to be acting in bad faith. That's one term that we use for people who don't keep their word. Then there's, yeah.
What's wrong with mechusar amana? Is it a derisive?
You, Erwin, are ahead of the curve. Just wait. Or if you want, you can jump down on the source sheets. If you take a look at the second of the questions and sources, and the ones that are associated, not everybody else, just our way, because we're not ready. But then you'll see that question being dealt with. It's a good question. But first, we have to introduce another category. There's a second label, which is called Ein Ruach Chachamim Nocha Heimenu, or in some texts it'll appear as Mimenu. What exactly does that mean? Ein Ruach Chachamim, the spirit of the sages, is not Nocha Heimenu. What could those last two words mean, especially if you saw this already on the source sheets from during the prep time? Good. So one way to read Nocha is that they're not, as you said, comfortable with him. They feel like this isn't right. We are not pleased with this conduct. And we're going to see the Rosh Mishans give that read, or Shimshon of Sen is going to give that explanation of what this line means, that the Chacham are not pleased with him. However, there's a second way to read it. Nocha can also mean... Sorry?
The spirit of Chachamim.
Well, that's the Ruach, right? But Nocha?
Rest?
No. To waft from. To emerge from. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 4 from the Ra'anach, Rabbi Eliyahu ben Chayim. So this requires some explanation. Not for all the groups I circulated among during the prep time who asked me, what in the world is this about? But for everybody else who I didn't get to. He's talking about a case which emerges from the Gemara in Bava Kama Daf Tzadi Daled. We have a general principle in Judaism, which is we like tshuva, right? We believe tshuva, repentance, is a good thing. And not only do we want Hashem to accept it when we repent, we want to help others to repent. So if they've done something wrong, and now they want to do right, we're supposed to help them do right. One classic example is what's called Takanas Merish, where the Chachamim enacted, the sages enacted. If a person stole a beam and built it into his house, and now he wants to do tshuva, we're not going to make him tear down his house in order to make things right. He can pay for the beam. He doesn't have to return the actual beam. This isn't Nineveh. We're not gonna make him tear down his house in order to do it. That's one tekla. Another one is what's referenced here from the Gemara in Bava Kama, which is the following: somebody stole something from you. He didn't get caught. There are no witnesses. However, he personally feels bad, and he comes to you and says, "I feel bad. I stole this from you. Would you please take this back?" He offers it back. Says the Gemara Bava Kama Daf Tzadi Daled, you're supposed to say thanks, but you can keep it. It's okay. Why? What's the rationale? In order to help him to tshuva. In order to make it more likely that he will indeed go straight now, and he will stop stealing, and that he'll fulfill his biblical mitzvah of offering it back, let him know it's okay. You can keep it. Mind you, he shouldn't try this a second time. Right? You can get away with this once. You can't get away with this twice. But that's the idea. You want to help people to repent.
Yeah. God is not accepting what he stole. Help him repent. Any more than if you accept what he stole. To me, that's more of, you're doing more tshuva by returning what you stole, recognizing that you did, something illegal, and that you're not going to do it again. How does it return?
Right. So,
but how does not accepting it make sure that he does tshuva as opposed to accepting it?
Right. Hold the question. Esther.
Also, does it also depend on what he stole from you?
I think he stole the baseball bat first, and then he used that as leverage. That right? Now, absolutely true, and it's part of what we're going to have to talk about. But in terms of the overall question, what Andrea is asking is, I think it's an important point. his tshuva will be lesser for the fact that he's holding on to the goods that he got inappropriately. However, the fear is that if people know that when they come to repent, they're losing everything, they're less likely to come forward. In the event that people know there's an element of amnesty, there's an element of clemency, it's more likely that they will discontinue their career of theft and say, you know what, I don't want to be part of this anymore. They do, as Max points out, make the attempt to return it. So they fulfill their biblical obligation of returning it. They did, and I just said keep it. I'm going to come back to Esther's point that it depends a little bit on, you know, what they took from you. I'm just not quite there yet. But that's the idea, is you make things easier for people to do tshuva. Mind you, what that means is that every time you see in the Gemara when they talk about the penalties for a thief, it's talking about somebody who got caught as opposed to somebody who came forward on his own. There were witnesses, there was a trial, this is talking about somebody who just comes forward on his own. This is a little bit tangential though. The rest of the line in Rabbi Eliyahu ben Chaim is really what I wanted, where he says in number 4, Kol mekabel ein ruach chacham no chayimenu, if you accept it back, he says, Ein ruach chachamim v'chasidus b'kirbo. The spirit of wisdom and piety is not in him. Meaning, if you accept this back in this case, you are not acting as somebody who is a chacham. So there are two ways to take Ein ruach chachamim no chayimenu. Either it means the sages are not pleased with him, or it means that's not the behavior of a sage. I gave you examples on the sheet of this. Another example is source number 5. You know that the end of Shemitah cancels outstanding debts. However, if you pay it back anyway, you say, I want to pay that back, that's the spirit of the Chachamim. That's what the sages either are pleased with, or that's an act of the sages. And anyone who keeps his word, HaMekayim es Devaro, Ruach Chachamim no Chayimenu. That's something that is an act of sages, or an act that the sages are pleased with. And then finally, in source number 6, back to our discussion, V'hanose v'nosein b'dvarim lo kana. If you engage in a verbal agreement for some kind of a commercial deal, it's not binding. Someone who backs out, Ein ruach chachamim nocha himenu. The sages are not pleased with him, or that's not the act of a sage. So now I have two terms. One, mechusar alana, it's in bad faith. And two, Ein ruach chachamim nocha himenu, somebody the sages are not pleased with. What's the difference? Why do I have two different terms? No. Why do I have two different terms?
Well, one carries a specific. It's in the Veira, presuming there will be a punishment for it. This one we just have our nose, we're not going to invite it to a party at our house. Mm-hmm. You don't like it.
What if I go back to Abaye's point to explain the Chusar Amana? Yeah?
Is this the difference between thinking, you're saying one thing and thinking something else? So you're right from the beginning, you're acting in bad faith. As opposed to, you meant what you said at the time, but circumstances change, so you're not going to fulfill your verbal agreement.
Precisely. As Abaye read it, Chanoch had explained it, Mechusar Amana, acting in bad faith, means from the beginning you didn't intend to keep your word. Ein ruach chachamim no chayimenu is somebody who, when he made the commitment, thought, I'm absolutely keeping my word. However, when it came time, he actually broke his word. They both refer to an element, obviously, of dishonesty, an element of impropriety, but at different ends of the transaction. That's the idea. The Rambam merges the two terms. If you take a look at source number 7.
That's why I said that's what you asked, because the Rambam merges.
Okay, you are correct then. I didn't realize that was what you meant. Take a look at the Rambam where he says, Hanose v'nose b'dvarim bilvad. If your interaction, if your commerce is only verbal, you should keep to your word. Even though you weren't paid anything, even though you didn't mark the merchandise, even though you didn't have a collateral, a pledge, nothing. And if you back out, whether the seller backs out, the buyer backs out, There is no Misha Para. Misha Para is a curse issued in or by a rabbinical court on somebody who actually backs out of an agreement after money has changed hands. So that's more severe. He says that doesn't apply here. Nonetheless, Hareza min chusarei amana, this is in bad faith. And he also applies, he also applies that the spirit of the sages is not pleased, or that this person has not acted as a sage. Max.
According to the Jewish theory, I was the same. But obviously, the next source defined judge that what involves an actual, that is actually a violation of the Nisr.
What do you mean the next source?
Source, Rabbi Shimon of Seth.
Ah, because we're getting there.
I mean, there's a distinction of what's the difference, but one difference is that one may be an actual Israel, while the other one may not be an actual Israel.
Maybe. Getting there. Sorry? Okay. So, right now what we have is that we use the terms mechusar amana, in bad faith, and ein racham nochay emenu, it's not acting like a sage, or the sages are not happy with this person, for breaking a verbal agreement, but however I read it, whether it's in the beginning, when he spoke that he didn't intend to keep it, or whether it's in the end that he didn't keep the agreement after the fact, no penalty is mentioned. It's an ethical violation. This isn't right behavior. However, so far it doesn't look like there's anything that's actionable in this. Yeah?
Can you distinguish a third one? That is, if you back out, you sell flax, or you buy flax, your house burns down, you have no place to put it, as opposed to the price is too high. Is that a distinguished?
Absolutely. And that's going to take me back towards what Esther was saying before, where there's a difference between telling the thief, you can keep the water bottle you took from me, and telling the thief, you can keep the diamond ring that you took from me. So I'm going to come back to that. Extenuating circumstances are going to be a factor in this conversation. So let's go a little further. Sam, you were going to ask? Okay. So what's wrong with breaking a verbal agreement? What law has a person broken within the Torah? So, a few different ways to look at it. One way to look at it, the Rosh Mishans, by the way, I'm assuming it's not actually pronounced Sens. I'm sure there's a French way to pronounce that, S-E-N-S, it was in France. Anybody tell me? Sens. Okay. Sounds good to me. What? Yes. So, Rabbeinu Shimshon, as we're going to call him now, or the Rosh Mishans, as we will also call him, says actually there is no prohibition. You haven't broken any rules. He says, if you fulfill your word, he's commenting on source number 5. It says, if you fulfill your word, the spirit of the sages is pleased, or that's acting like the sages. If you don't fulfill your word, the Chachamim are not happy with him. V'lav mishum de'ika iser. There's no prohibition. Devar made by mishum chusari amana. There's no issue of lack of good faith. There's no issue of in bad faith if a person simply breaks a verbal agreement. He seems to be taking the view of whom? In source number 3, sorry, Rav. He seems to be following Rav against Rabbi Yochanan. Unfortunately for him, we follow Rabbi Yochanan. But he seems to be taking the stance of Rav. Let's go a step up. Got it? Let's go a step up. The next step up is that there is a prohibition, but we have to figure out what it is. And here we come back to Rabbi Eliyahu ben Chaim in source number 9. Umikom makom eich sheyiyya ledaz hamakshe, sorry, eich sheyiyya, ledaz hamakshe vaday hachi hava. He's responding to somebody. And he says, the person who asked him this question certainly believes, as I added in brackets, the yesh iser mamash, that there is a full prohibition. He thinks that that line that said your hain has to be true applies in the case of Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, which was not about the time when you made the agreement, but it's about the time when you decide later, I don't want to carry it out. That's under the rule of hain tzedek, hin tzedek as well. The iser sheyesh lo smach min ha-Torah, and even though there is a biblical basis for it, the him tzedek idea, katani Allah b'masnisin ein rachacham nochei menu, all they say is the chachamim are not happy. The shaper mishtama miloshon ein rachacham nochei menu, the isura isbe, which sounds like there is some kind of prohibition. He says there's a biblical basis for it, but he doesn't quite think it's a biblical prohibition. It's prohibited, but not necessarily biblically. That's the position that he takes. And he says, V'chein amrinan sham, da'am rav yochanan, ha'omer lachavero matana, and he knows elach mutter lachzer bo. He says, the Gemara says, the rav yochanan says, if you say to somebody else, I'm going to give you a gift. You made a statement, I'm giving you a present. If you make such a statement, you're allowed to back out. When is that true? As the Gemara continues, the matana maruba. If what you promised him was a large present, you promised him a large gift, you can back out. You promised him a small gift, you can't back out. What's the difference?
Expectations.
Expectations. You promise someone a small gift, he believes you. You promise someone a large gift, that's another story. He's not so convinced. But the position of Rabbi Eliyahu ben Chaim is there is an Isser, but he doesn't pin it down to anything in particular. The Nimuke Yosef, who I brought you in source number 10, gives you a source. It's funny that he calls it Dirabanan because he actually is referring to a pasuk in Sefania. He says, I'm skipping the beginning of it, the Osamase Amcha, it's not relevant for us. The person who backs out, lo osem maase amcha, is not acting the way that Jews are supposed to act. Dichsiv, as the pasuk says, she'eris Yisrael lo yasu avlav lo yedavru chazav. The remnant of Israel will not act corruptly, will not speak falsehood. We are on the up and up. We are going to be honest. We are going to tell the truth. That's what Sefania says. And so, in the event that you violate your word, you're breaking that description that Sefania gave. You're not speaking honestly. That's the idea. So it's a derabanan. And then you have those who argue, no, it's actually a deoraisa. Go back to Hain Tzedek, and that's a biblical issue. And I brought you that in source number 11, the position of the Ravid, that it sounds like there is indeed a potential to say that Hain Tzedek is actually considered to be a Deoraisa, and he goes through the problem of, well, what's Rav going to do, and how will he apply it? But that's the idea. I'm just looking at the time and recognizing we have a lot to cover still. But this is the view that it is potentially a deoraisa. And again, you have to ask yourself, and this is what the Ravid is asking, is that only to mean your words at the time that you say them, or does it even apply to a person who meant it when they said it, and then afterward change their mind? I think you can make the argument both ways. Just trying to figure out how much I can fit in from that. Maybe I'll come back to it later, but there are too many other things to see, and I don't want to get bogged down on that piece. Okay, so right now what we have is the statement that Ein Racham Nochei Menu Mechusar Amana, maybe a violation of nothing, maybe a violation of a Dirabanan, maybe a violation even of something that is on a biblical level. So I now want to introduce you to a third level, and this one has more teeth to it. And this is what's called, in Hebrew, in Israeli Hebrew, taromet, in Ashkenazi loose Hebrew, taromes. What does taromes mean? Or taromet? Sorry? No, not ramaut. This is with an ayin. Taf resh ayin vav mem taf. Taromet.
Complaint.
Right? Lehitra'im is to complain. Ra'am is thunder. Probably associated. A taromet is when somebody has a complaint against somebody else. And I brought you a table below the line on the sheet that says there may be repercussions, which is going to sum up the cases we're going to look at here. There are more cases than the ones I'm bringing here, but these I think should suffice. The common denominator in all of these cases is that somebody makes a verbal agreement and does not live up to it, and the harm involved is primarily non-financial, although not exclusively so. The first case we're going to see, the first type, involves some kind of minimal financial cost. Take a look at source number 14, the beginning of the sixth parak in Bava Metzia, which we've been learning this year. Hasocher es ha'umnin, you hired craftsmen, v'hitu zeh et zeh, and one side tricked the other. We don't know what that means yet. Ein lam zeh al zeh ela taromes. The only thing they have against each other is taromes, a complaint. Says the Gemara, that's an interesting choice of words. Hitu zed zed, they tricked each other. Chazu bezeh zebazeh lo katani. Doesn't say they backed out on each other. One of them showed up for work and the other one said, ha, there's no job for you. That's not it. Ela hitu zed zed, they tricked each other. Da'atu polim ahadadi. Workers tricked each other. And what that means is, he envisions a case in which you have a contractor. The boss went to the contractor and said, I want you to hire workers for me, and here's what you should promise them. This contractor, went to the workers and promised them less. That will be an example of hitu zed zed. The boss says to the middleman, hire workers for me, and he went and tricked them, and then it plays out in the Gemara. They talk about different types of tricks that could be going on in this case, but the bottom line is that either the boss ends up being tricked into paying more, or the workers end up being tricked into receiving less. And there we say, the penalty indeed is taromes. What is complaint? We'll come back to it. But that's the penalty here. That's type one. We'll also see another case that may involve some financial loss, shortly involving a boat. But I want to move to type two. Type two is where the cost to the person who was tricked is not money, but effort or time. So, did anybody get to see source number 15? No one got to number 15. Ah, wait, the Niederhoppers got to number 15. Okay, you don't have to be humble. They got to number 15. Here we get to people who indeed backed out. Ibayis Ema, if you want, they're trying to explain what the case was of tricking each other in the Mishnah. Hai Tana Chazu Nami Hitu Kari Lei, the author of the Mishnah, when he said Hitu, they tricked each other, included within that backing out. They backed out on each other. Ditanya, as the Brisa teaches, we learn the following. Hasokhra Sa'umnin Vehitu as Balabayis. You hired workers, you hired craftsmen, and they tricked the boss. Balabayis Hitu Osan, or the boss tricked them. Elam zelze ela taromes. The only thing you have is taromes, a complaint. What does this look like? But medevar mamur, what are your circumstances? What was the trick? Shelo halchu, they didn't show up. So in other words, tell me if you've heard this one, right? You hired somebody to come, clean up the leaves in your yard, or you hired somebody to fix something in the house, and lo and behold, the day comes, they're not there. They don't show. What do you have against them? Probably the same thing that the Gemara says. Nothing changes. Taromes. You can rant and rave. You give them a bad review online. We have to talk about what exactly taromes looks like. But that's what it's talking about, he says. Taromes is, you hired somebody, they didn't show up to do the job, and therefore you have this complaint. What did they actually cost you in the end? Aggravation. No, don't laugh. Aggravation and what else? Time. Why time? Well, you were waiting. What else? You have to go get somebody else. I have to go through the process again. Right? I hired them. Now, because they didn't show, I have to hire somebody else. I have to go do this all over again. So there's an element of strain, there's an element of time that is involved, and here I get to another case. Source number 16. This one, Rabbi Bergman just finished giving a three-part series on this Gemara. We're not going to do the entire Gemara in the three-part series. We're going to take this Gemara very simply. But Amar Rabba Bar Rav Huna Amar Rav. Rabba Bar Rav Huna says, quoting Rav, Hasocher es hachamor lerkov aleha. You hired a donkey to ride, umeis alo b'chatzi aderech, and it dies halfway. Nosem l'schor shachatzi aderech. You pay the owner of the donkey for the route that you got. So you wanted to go from Toronto to New York City. That was you had in mind. You're selling your merchandise. You've got your goods all set to sell it. And lo and behold, the donkey dies in Binghamton. Syracuse. Okay. The donkey dies somewhere in Binghamton. Sorry, when you've seen this Gemara as often as we've discussed it this year, you have a whole litany of places that could fit. But the donkey died in Binghamton. You have to pay him for a donkey ride to Binghamton, even though now you're stranded in Binghamton. And what's your claim against the owner of the donkey? Haromes.
You shouldn't even have it. He's a donkey died. It's not as if he killed the donkey.
Good. I'm going to come back to that point. I'm not there yet, but Arnie is correct. It's not as though you were set up. Right? It's not as though you were set up, we assume. So we're going to have to come back to that point. I'm just not quite there yet. But you are correct.
But the person who owned the donkey, only find the donkey, or just say,
no. So that's actually where our three-part series went, was the question of, does he have any obligation to provide a new donkey? But let's assume right now he's not providing anything. He's got no more donkeys. He wasn't U-Haul, you know, where he could just, you know, send you another one. He's got no other donkeys. However, one of the key elements in this discussion is there another donkey that you could rent? In other words, is there another one available such that you could actually find another donkey? But I don't want to get bogged down in that right now. This is where it costs you time and it costs you strength. So first we had some financial cost, right? That was the first one. Where there's an element of financial cost involved. They tricked you into accepting less money than you could have gotten for doing the work. Then we have the strain of finding new workers or finding a new donkey. And then the third one is just the aggravation one. The emotional strain. Take a look, please, at source number 17. This Gemara also admits of multiple reads. We're going to stick with one. You hired a boat. Okay, you had goods. You were bringing the goods somewhere to sell. You hired a boat. And then partway through, as I'm reading this Gemara, you unloaded. You found someone to buy your stuff. Yeah, see you later. I'm getting off here, presumably at a port, not, you know, in the middle of the water. This isn't a coronavirus case. You unloaded the boat halfway through. No se lo scharo shalchatzi aderech. So you pay for half the trip. Ve'en lo alav ela taromes. And the owner of the boat only has this complaint against the person who unloaded his goods. That's all that he has. Even though he now has to go find new people for his boat, is what it sounds like. However, I'm just trying to figure out how to do this most easily. Do it most smoothly. So, yes.
So it's all to do.
All verbal.
Yeah. What if your contract isn't take my goods by donkey or take my goods by ship, but the contract is get my goods from point A to point B. I don't care how you get it there. I'll pay you X number of dollars to get it there. What is the responsibility of the person who's contracted to transport the goods there? Still just if whatever means he used breaks down, or...
So that goes back to that three-part series. That's exactly what that... No, that's like the key question, is Are you actually hiring a donkey, or are you hiring the means to get there, and therefore whatever, you know, he'll have to replace it in order to get you there?
I think in civil law nowadays, that if you contract somebody, I'm not sure whether it's verbal or not, but if you contract somebody to take someone to New York, and you stop partnering, say, this is as a one goal, you stop contractual agreement, you stop cash.
Right, so again, today's formulation is going to be a little bit different. Today's formulation is going to be a little bit different because I think it is working with the assumption, if you say, I need to get from point A to point B, that that's actually what you're doing, and the donkey is only the means of getting you there, but you're actually contracting for the service. I think that's the way that it'll be looked at today. But in terms of this case, the case that's in source number 17, the Gemara then goes through different ways to read the story. One of the ways to read the story is not that you unloaded, but actually that you brought more goods onto the boat, which necessitates that the owner of the boat is going to have to spend on more ropes, longer ropes, as part of drawing the boat along in the river. Or alternatively, that there are new customers coming onto the boat, and now the boat owner says, I'm going to have to get used to dealing with them. I liked you. I worked with you on the boat. Everything was fine. We were happy. Now you leave. New guys come. I don't know if we're going to get along. It's there's an element of stress here that I don't want to have to deal with that kind of adjustment. It's an emotional strain. It's an aggravation issue. So three different elements, three different things that may trigger this taromes complaint. However, now I come back to Esther's point, which Andrea also raised in a slightly different way, which is, I'll take the most recent case, the case of the donkey. Right? The donkey owner did not intend for his donkey to die. Right? He didn't want the donkey to die. So Tosfos suggests that explains why the person who rented the donkey has to pay for what he got. He has to pay for having gotten halfway to his destination. He didn't want to be stranded in Binghamton. He didn't want to be stuck halfway where he was going. He wanted to go the whole way. So why does he have to pay for half the route? Tosfos says, because it was ones. It wasn't like it wasn't as though the owner of the donkey planned for it or would have wanted this to happen. He got hurt also. So because it wasn't something that he wanted to have happen, therefore you will pay him for half the route. It was a circumstance beyond his control. Another type of justification which would actually mitigate a taromes complaint would be the boat case. The Marsha talks about this. He says, you're going to complain about the boat guy unloading his merchandise? He found a buyer. Why should he have to travel all the way to the originally promised destination to sell goods there, hoping he's going to find a buyer there? He found a buyer halfway through. He's justified in wanting to back out. This comes up a lot. This comes up a lot. Imagine the following circumstance. One of our two opening cases, the summer camp case, right? I agreed to send my kid to the summer camp. The summer camp costs, I'm just making up numbers, the summer camp costs $5,000. There's another summer camp that, in truth, I really would have preferred to have used. However, that summer camp was charging $6,000. So I agreed to go with the $5,000 one, verbal agreement. That's all there was. No money changed hands, not even a deposit. I went with the $5,000. Then, the $6,000 summer camp realizes what's going on, and they say, oh, we got to compete. They drop to $4,500. Says the Baal HaMor, I can back out on my original agreement without a taromes, without any complaint against me. It was because the price changed. Therefore, I am justified in walking away. So one justification is it was owning something beyond my control, like the donkey died. Another justification is where I can actually get a better deal elsewhere. They take that back to Bava, to Rav Kahana and the flax that we discussed in the beginning. Maybe there we actually view things differently. A third justification to avoid taromes is if the harm that's caused is not really that great, it's not such a big deal. Then we'll say also you can back out and there's no taromes. Yes, Max.
In the case of Rav Kahana, he got his stuff from Rav, and it's pretty clear that the post you bring that halacha according to Rav Yochanan.
Correct.
Yes.
Right.
I checked the Yehi Mishpat to see.
No, it's true. It's true. We follow Rabbi Yochanan. I'm not clear on the on how the Baal HaMor squares with that. It's the Baal HaMor's position. It's not everybody's position. Not everybody agrees with the Baal HaMor. But you're right.
Does
the Baal HaMor.
Does he bring halacha down according to Rav, or does he still say halacha when I say like Rabbi
Yochanan? I don't remember. The answer is I don't remember. Yeah, but because take a look, it's a Baal HaMor, it's Chav Tesamid Beis in the Daf Arif in Baf Mitzvah.
Is this the Milchamos Hashem there fun to read?
I don't believe so. So the so again, what we've now defined are three levels. We have Mechusar Amana for the person who never meant it in the never meant to keep it in the first place. Einu Rachacham Nochei Menu for the person who doesn't keep to his agreement, and Taromes. Where there's fallout. Complaint where there's fallout. So what exactly does this mean in practice? Bottom line, I did it. Now what? What's my obligation? So the Tiferes Yisrael argues you have no obligation. Tiferes Yisrael, Yisrael Lipschitz, in source number 18, commenting on the Mishnah, says, Taromes, midaloka amar yeshlen taromes ze al ze, he says, the language of Taromes is, all you have is Taromes. Not, you have Taromes against the guy. The reason is, because you have nothing against him whatsoever. Taromes means, go complain. Good luck. That's it. Taromes means, you got nothing. That's the way that the Tiferes Yisrael reads Taromes. However, if you flip the page, the Brisha commenting on the tour says, no. The Ivoy Elios Nakimea Taromes Tzarech Lefaiso, brackets Bimamon. He says, if you want to be clean of Taromes, if you don't want people to have a Taromes against you, you're going to have to make it right to him, which generally speaking means financial. Correct, but it suggests that there's a problem with people being mad at you. It's not just like, well, you're mad, so what? It suggests that there is a need to balance things out. Some actually make the argument that the reason why there is a need to balance things out is that halacha does recognize a level of kinyan, a level of transaction, even just from a verbal agreement. Even though we've said there is no such thing as a kinyan, there's no such thing as a transaction with devarim, with words alone, nonetheless, Tosos makes the argument that there are cases in which words indeed are binding. Like the case I gave before about the gift, where you said to somebody, I'm going to give you a gift, and it was a small gift. He was entitled to anticipate that you actually were going to follow through. There is the possibility that there is some kind of quasi-transaction going on, even though legally you can back out. And that would be why there would be an expectation of paying something. Yeah.
When you talk about kinyan,
yes.
If you make a verbal agreement with a kinyan, does that give it a higher level of obligation in the case where the person prepaid for the flax?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a different situation than if there's just a verbal agreement to pay X number of dollars?
You bet. You bet. There's also something which we haven't gotten into at all called a kinyan sudar. If you think about what happens when you ask the rabbi to sell your chametz for you, right? Or you see it go on in the early stages of a wedding, where there are words that are exchanged and then someone picks up a handkerchief or a pen, right? That's an act of kinyan. That's an act of transaction which makes everything much more serious and much more binding. Then we've left the category of being purely verbal.
But with selling permits, you actually sign it.
Right.
But I'm talking about the case where there's no written document, just in this case, in exchange of if they said he prepaid, that he actually gave the person money for X number of bushels of flax and X number of dollars.
Right. So to me, it's questionable that a signature actually constitutes a Kenyan. Right, but I'm saying the signature. I don't think matters a whole lot. I want to make sure to wrap this by 11:30, so I'm going to ask you to hold the question, Max.
Okay.
Is that okay? All right. Okay. The big question that you still have to deal with is what does Taromas actually look like? What happens with this complaint? So the truth is, you don't get description in the Gemara of what Taromas looks like. You don't get description really in the commentators about what Taromas looks like. Everyone just takes it as a given that you know. However, there is description of what happens with Mechusar Amana when someone acts in bad faith. We turn to a Rashi. Rashi is in number 21, but he's commenting on the Gemara in number 20. They're talking about where a coin was used in a transaction, and it turns out to be no good. So there's a certain period of time when you're allowed to return the coin, demand a refund. However, after a certain period of time, it's too late. So Rav Chisda says, commenting on this, particular case in the Gemara, he says, the case that they're describing involves accepting a coin back as a matter of chasidus, as a matter of special piety, saying, I'm not obligated to accept it back, but I'm going to take it back anyway. And in such a case where a person returns the coin to you after the deadline, and you choose to accept it back because you're a chasid, because you're a very pious person, all you who has received the coin back have against the person who returned it to you is taromes, is a complaint. So in other words, you're a really nice guy. You're great. You accepted the coin back. All you, the nice guy, have against the other guy is taromes, is a complaint. So Rashi says in source number 21, wait a minute. Oh, well, first the Gemara, I jumped the gun. The Gemara asks the question at the end of source number 20. Who is it who has the complaint in this case? If it's the chassid, the pious person who accepted the coin back, he's the one who has the complaint. Lo kabuli lichbalamine, v'lo taromas lahavile. Why does he need to have a taromas? Just say no. If you don't want to accept the coin back, legally you're within your rights not to accept the coin back. Why are you accepting it back and then complaining? That's the Gemara's question. On which Rashi comments in source number 21, giving us insight into what taromes would have looked like. He says, "Tov lo shelo yekablena, mi sheyekablena v'yotzi diba al chaveru." Better for him not to accept it back than to accept it back and speak badly about the other guy. In other words, what Rashi is telling you, I just said I didn't have a source on taromes, especially this is on taromes, my mistake. Rashi is telling you, taromes is not just something you keep in your heart. I'm angry at him. It's actually something that you go say to other people. And that's why the Gemara is objecting. The Gemara is saying, why would you want to go tell Lashon Hara about other people? You're such a nice guy. You're a sweetheart. You accepted the coin back. In order to be able to go tell everybody what a rotten guy this is, we'd rather that you don't accept the coin back. Thank you very much. I mean, there are people like this. but that's not an ideal. So the way that Rashi explains taromes is that you would actually speak out negatively about the person who engaged in this inappropriate behavior. That's the way that Rashi makes it sound. However, the Mordechai in source number 22 does not say that. Look at the case in number 22. In the interest of time, I'll stick with my English translation. Reuven said to Shimon, I have business in such and such a place. This is merchandise I'd like to buy. Go buy it for us. We'll go in together. Shimon went and bought it. Reuven said, okay, thank you for the purchase. Split it with me. And Shimon says, no, I'm buying it. I got it off myself. Thank you for the stock tip. I'm not interested in sharing it with you. Shimon refused. Save Reuven gave Shimon money to buy it together, and there was a kinyan. Andrea, you see there was an actual kinyan there. Shimon has to give Reuven his portion on the word of the Beit Din. And if Shimon never accepted money, and it was only verbal, and then Shimon recanted, as I underlined, the Beis Din informs him of the penalty for violating a prohibition. The Beis Din says, you know you're breaking the law by backing out, because you have to have the hin tzedek, you have to speak honestly. But that's all that taromes is. Beis Din says to him, you know what you did wasn't nice. Not like what Rashi sounds like, which is that it's a more public phenomenon. What will be the justification for doing this in public?
Someone else would.
Right. So the most simple explanation for why you'd be justified in doing this in public is indeed toelis, is indeed to help save others from trouble. Another justification that's brought is reprisal. You hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. That's actually brought. Because his actions were what we called earlier, eino osem maaseh amcha. He's not acting the way a Jew is supposed to act. He has excluded himself from the protection from reprisal. There's a third argument that actually by announcing what he's done wrong, you create a duty for him to repay you. The announcement is actually what does it. But indeed there is evidence in the sources that this was done, Taromes was conducted in a public way. Take a look back now in source number 23, which is the conclusion of what we saw in the beginning, the case of the Mohel. The question was, again, you hired a Mohel to take care of the bris. The bris was delayed. Mohel left town. Then he decided to do the bris. He's not around. You hire somebody else. Both of them show up on the same day. Who gets to do the bris? So the Maharam Rutenberg responds in number 23, my English translation. He replied, it happened in the time of Rabbeinu Tam that one gave his son to a Mohel to circumcise, and then another one preceded him. The second one got in first. How that happened, I have no idea, but that's what happened. He showed up in shul, pretended he was the Mohel, and he was the Mohel, but just not the right one, and he did it. He stole the baby from the father. I have no idea. The first one then claimed payment for the bracha in court. He says, hey, you have to pay me. You took my mitzvah. They asked Rabbeinu Tam. He replied, where there is no financial loss, meaning you failed to gain something, but it didn't cost you money out of your pocket. Our courts do not represent, meaning the ordained courts of old, we are not empowered to handle cases like this as the original Batei Din were. Even if the injured party took assets, we would remove them from him. If the first Mohel, the one who was supposed to do it, went in and grabbed money from the second one, we wouldn't say, well, you got your payment now. We would actually make him return it. But if one had not already gone ahead of the other, and both were standing before us, then certainly the one to whom he vowed first would precede. You have to give it to the one he promised it to first. It's no worse than people who know Kohanim and Levium, this is a Gemara, where we consider the tithes to have arrived in their hands, meaning that if you have a particular Kohen you always give your Truma to, it's like the Truma is his, even before he has received it. It has halach ramifications. But if he backed out, so you're supposed to give it to the first Mohel, you didn't do it. Rivam explained the court can't prevent him from doing so. You can't stop the guy from taking a different Mohel. He would only violate the remnant of Israel will not act corruptly and will not speak falsely. You're not supposed to back out. You should go with the one to whom you promised it in the first place. And I actually realized I didn't bring my entire source on that, so it's missing the key. Oh, no, it is. It is there. I didn't translate it. I didn't translate the last three words. Sorry. I missed the punchline of the hour. The umutar likroso rasha. If a person does not keep his word, you are permitted to call him wicked. That's actually a public declaration. Notice Taromes was not just you can be aggravated and fume inside, but you could actually publicly declare the person wicked. It's an act of shaming, essentially, for having done so. So hopefully, if you go back to the first side and the questions and sources to see during preparation, we now know acting in bad faith is not necessarily the same thing as Ein Ruach Chacham Nochai Emenu. Acting in bad faith is at the time that you made the agreement. Ein Ruach Chacham Nochai Emenu is not following through according to Abaye. What law does one break by breaking a verbal agreement? Possibly nothing. possibly a derabbanan associated with Zephaniah, possibly a biblical prohibition, Hain Tzedek. You have to keep your yeses. What types of harm trigger the higher repercussions of Taromes? So we suggested that there are repercussions if you cost him some minimal amount of money, or even you just cost him strain and time, or even aggravation. And the penalties that are associated with it may well include a public declaration that this person is wicked for not keeping his word. So may we all go forth and keep our words in our agreements. Thank you very much.